Today's episode of Data Driven is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/datadriven.
Hello and welcome to Data Driven, the podcast where we explore the emerging field of data science. We bring the best minds in data, software engineering, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. Now here are your hosts, Frank Lavinia and Andy Leonard.
Hello and welcome back to Data Driven, the podcast where we explore the emerging worlds of data science, software engineering, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff that you can do with data today. How you doing, Andy?
I'm doing well, Frank. How about you?
Doing great. I'm doing great. So guess what happened, Andy?
What happened?
I passed my 9th Microsoft Data Science Certificate class.
Woohoo!
So I am 90% an officially certified data scientist.
Nice.
What do you think?
I am very impressed.
Thank you. Thank you. But you know what else?
What else?
I have to wait until July to take the final capstone project.
Oh, no.
I know. It's painful. I've been working hard to be ready for this by May 1st.
I do.
And then I found out. They only offer it for the first month of each quarter.
That's okay. Take a little break. Give your brain some
breaks.
Rest.
There's no breaks in this train, Andy. not the F train.
I hear that. Well, we're recording this right smack in the middle of May. So you've got about, 6-7 weeks until
right.
July 1st. So
I have not been idle. I actually, there's another... series of certifications I've been taking on Hadoop and HD Insight on Azure.
Nice.
As well as a few other things that I'm trying to get certified on AWS as well. So, once you get the train moving, it's just a lot easier to keep it moving than to slow it down and start up again. So
I hear that. I have not been getting certifications. Instead, I've been writing in the hopes of helping other people achieve the BIML Hero certification. At some point in the future, we are working on a title now for APRES that's tentatively named the BIML book. We're hoping to get that out by the end of 2017, and it's coming along.
Very cool. We'll have to get somebody from the BIML crew to kind of talk about what BIML is, because there's probably some folks scratching their head as to what exactly BIML is.
True. And I've spoken to someone about it. I've spoken to Mr. Bimmel himself. I've given away too much already, but he's interested in coming on the podcast. He is just extremely busy right now trying to get the next build out.
I understand. And his name isn't Bimmel, right? We're talking about BIML.
No. We got Bimmel, Business Intelligence Markup Language. His name is not Bimmel, but Scott Curry is his name. So.
So if you'd like to Google or Bing, those are probably the terms you want to look for before we have him on the show, if you're impatient.
Absolutely.
But speaking of being patient, we have somebody waiting here on the line. Who are we talking to today, Andy?
It's Mark Tabadillo, and Mark is a friend of mine, from way back. And Mark is currently a lead data scientist for Microsoft Services at the Data Insights Domain Center of Excellence. Prior to this, he worked a lot with SAS. I met Mark when he was doing a lot with SAS, and he was also working with the Microsoft Business Intelligence Stack. I'm not just saying this. Mark's one of the smartest people I know, and I have an awful lot of respect for him professionally. But beyond that, I have a lot of respect for Mark personally, and I'm just so excited. I can't wait to get this recorded, get this out there, and have people learn more about my friend and brother, Mark.
Welcome to the show, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for the intro. And, Frank, of course, we're new friends, but I'm looking now at your Facebook page, and we have a lot of common friends there, just stories, from different people that you've known that we commonly know. And so I'm just glad to be on this podcast today.
Cool. Well, we're definitely glad to have you. Microsoft's doing a lot of exciting things in data science.
Sure, we are. And And I am only, I feel like it's such a small part of the whole thing, and of course I am. My Microsoft now is approaching like 200,000 employees with the acquisition of LinkedIn. And the data scientists work in roughly two areas. One is in the product development, building the next generation. And the other group, large group, is client-facing and solving solving solutions or creating solutions for our clients. And that's where my focus is.
What do clients typically think they'll get out of data science? Because I've been seeing kind of clients in my world all over the map in terms of what they expect it'll do. First, it's magic. Then it's predictive maintenance. What are people asking you for?
Sure. And a fair question. And one thing that I was able to do with a lot of the projects is help focus the scope. And so sometimes we would get statements of work, which are SOWs. We need to have those in place before we work on client projects. They have to be written clearly and have deliverables. So what has happened, and a number of these SOWs I've seen in the past year have not been well written in the areas where I needed them to be well written. So just a comment you just said about magic. I mean, I just went to a client last week, and they, you know, he was saying, oh, we want something that's earth-shattering. We want something that's going to disrupt our industry. And, you know, I don't know if he's doing that to encourage us, you know, like go get them team. Like the coach, it's like, you know, it's halftime and we got to get the ball across the goal line and that type of encouragement. But when it comes to a point of a contract, I mean, we can't write language like that into a contract in terms of an expectation or deliverable. So we do want to capture that energy. We do want that for our strategic relationships. We want that there as far as a long term. But in terms of a tactical plan, yes, there is a different way to think about tactically. We have to focus on objective deliverables. What are we going to build? What type of reasonable expectations do we see for this particular build? While at the same time, we're also aspiring for that strategic, earth-shattering or industry disruption.
Interesting.
Yeah, Mark, I don't know about this. I've been watching, you know, some of the financial channels, and they seem to be talking more like your client. I don't know if you're a real data scientist or not, if you're not delivering earth-shattering.
Right.
I'm kidding. Now, I get it, there have been some great stories out there where people have actually delivered the magic, and I think that's what everybody wants, and you know, they kind of come to expect that now. How do you manage those expectations?
Right. So, in our particular work, my particular team focuses on short-term projects. So, when I say short-term, maybe only a few months or less. And the purpose of our team and my center of excellence, we're there to build pilot solutions. We don't like to do POCs. POCs just a demonstration of technology with their data. We will do it, but we do want to do pilots, which is the grain of a production solution, something that people will build on. It's the beginning of a new future. And
right.
We want to start, and we always do start, with what is going to change your world? And yes, we are working Azure, we are working cloud, but we're not thinking about the technology first. We're trying to think about their business focus. And so going back to your original question, and then I think that some of this does come with experience. And I turn out to be, even at 1 year, I just celebrated my 1 year anniversary with Microsoft. Even at 1 year, I still have a lot more experience in scoping a data science investigation than the majority of my colleagues. Now, not all of my colleagues, and in fact, the team that I'm on is very experienced. So I'm very confident about the other lead data scientists that I'm working with, because they have their own base of experience, and there are others too. But some of it is experience, and I do like to have, in any of these scoping discussions, I do want to hear from a number of different people. I do want to hear from people who have different technology backgrounds who will be contributing to solution in whether they think this is a feasible direction, and have that discussion up front. So I do want to hear from a number of different people, and I think a variety of experts listening in on a solution is a good approach.
I mentioned your background earlier when I was introducing you. You came from an SAS background. Is that where you started with data science?
I would say yes, and partly. I think my journey in this area started when I was at UCLA. I happened to take a statistics class, and I was very interested in that topic. And even back then, we did have a separate class called numerical analysis. Now, you don't see that phrase around anymore, but all the techniques in numerical analysis is all the algorithms that people are using now to do the numerical fitting. And we were doing programming back then in Pascal, and people had to write programs. And one of the problems was predict the location of a satellite as it goes around the Earth. And what you have to do is you have to estimate the equation, and then there's a falling rate. And then you add the little pieces up together one at a time, and you should get back to where you were at the beginning or pretty close.
Wow.
And that's, for example, a thing that you can do. I mean, someone can show you the equations for that. But I love that class. And in fact, I don't even told a lot of people this, but later on, I took a part-time job as a grader for that class. And so I was grading the homework for numerical analysis, and I was grading the exams too. And I actually had the approach, if somebody wanted to come in for a regrade on their exam, I was going to look at the entire thing.
Wow.
It's like, okay, I will regrade it, but I will look at the whole exam. So, you know, and because it is a learning experience, and, you know, so sometimes people did lose points, by the way. net. I mean, but they should, right? Well, shouldn't they? So that was the beginning of a journey. Then I will skip forward to SAS. SAS was something I used as a graduate student at Georgia Tech. Like many colleges and universities, SAS has made partnerships to make their software free, even though it's insanely expensive even then and today for corporate users. And I think people are realizing now in data science, you do have to have a free path for people to learn these tools, because they cannot be expected to pay for their learning in that sense. And there's a way to make that work. In the case of SAS, they were not sponsoring the hardware. Georgia Tech had to put up the hardware, and they just provided the license. So there are ways to get people on the learning path. And then after that, I had a career in SAS. I've spoken at a number of conferences. A lot of my presentations are out there at lexjansen.com. And that's where I stayed for a while, until I came to Microsoft.
We toss around this term data science all the time, right? You can't walk 5 miles in Silicon Valley without somebody being a data science or some kind of artificially intelligence-related startup. You can't look around the web for very long without hearing about data.
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is, I mean, numerical analysis, I mean, this stuff isn't necessarily new.
Right. The topics are not new, but the what is new is maybe the technology, or maybe the accessibility, or maybe the amount of data that you can process with it. And Andy, I don't know if anyone's shared this with you about SAS. A good amount of the people I know who were SAS consultants or running SAS practices, they actually were doing ETL. And a lot of them were working on the mainframe. SAS got licensed by a lot of mainframe shops because it was so much better than a lot of the other tools. So were they statisticians? No. But they had ample ability to make really good livings and even start businesses and employ people. And I would even say, you know, I don't know the number, but I do know, first of all, people who are using SAS needed to be pretty good at the ETL period, or at least ETL thinking. Speed may or may not have been that important back in those days for most applications, because we're not trying to support OLTP. However, I feel still probably more than half the work was probably in the ETL space. And when you think about, I mean, your passion for BIML today, I mean, the SAS macro language did something for SAS, which is very similar, and that is was a code generator. So, anybody who really wanted a career in SAS really needed to learn macro. And that's what I had told people. I even showed people how to use SAS macro.
Interesting. Yeah, there's definitely a long pole in the data science tent, and it is that data munging, data wrangling, data integration, ETL, shaping the data so that it's in the right format to be consumed by these really cool engines, and also cleansed as well, because you know, with our new shiny tech doing predictive analytics and the like, one of the outcomes of that is it's very easy to quickly produce awesome looking graphics that are completely inaccurate. You know, and I keep telling people that it's, you know, garbage in still equals garbage out. You have to do the cleansing, you have to shape the data, and it's still there's still an awful lot of data integration involved in that. And you're right, Mark. I'm focused on BEML tech mostly these days, because I think we can drop that percentage of the project, like you mentioned, it's more than half. If we can reduce that number, we can do data science faster.
Right.
And given the cost, you know, the hourly rate, you know, data scientists cost, I mean, it's a real shame to pay somebody that much money to sift through text files.
Sure.
This too reminds me, I'll do a shout out for Jen Underwood. She posted something, I think it was around the end of April, 2017, where she's saying that she's getting, you know, she's talking to a CEO who got hundreds of resumes for data scientists, and they're all recent graduates of an online course, and none of them really have experience in getting the data into the shape, Mark, that you're talking about.
Right.
And
I think
that experience from, you know, what we used to call decision support, and now we call business intelligence, and are beginning to call data science, I think that's still a valid skill.
And this is the point in the show where we thank our sponsors who make Data Driven possible. You know, on Data Driven, we talk a lot about data science, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. But did you know the hardest part of any data science related project is data integration? Data scientists often call data integration data wrangling, or the icky word, munging. But it's all about making sure the analytics engine that you're using has valid and clean data. Enterprise Data and Analytics specializes in data integration and can help your enterprise build better data integration solutions faster with best practices and automation. Enterprise Data and Analytics offers training and consulting services for SQL Server Integration Services, SSIS, and Business Intelligence Markup Language, or BIML. Visit entdna.com to learn more. Enterprise Data and Analytics. Data, it's in their DNA.
Yes, and you know, I've already worked with several people in the Microsoft organization, and you know, all I can do is encourage people to go forward. One of them didn't know how to do SQL well, but was willing. The other one said, "No, I don't want to learn SQL." It's like, okay.
Wow.
But yet, I know. You know, they want to do data science, and they learned R somewhere, and they want to do regression models. But learning the scope of skills is important. I know as we started this broadcast, you mentioned the Microsoft Professional Data Science degree. In my role this year, we are required to have certification by the end of our fiscal year. So it was just this week that I passed the 7475 certification exam for my requirement. And I also had the alternative of doing the professional data science degree. But the
wow.
Azure technologies are so important now for us to even have a conversation. We show up, and of course, all right, so there's two types of magic out there. So if I show up at random client, yes, they're going to be thinking about what can we do with the data. But the other hand, they're also getting a lot of information from Microsoft. Maybe they go to Build or Ignite or some of these other conferences, and they may learn about who knows what in Azure, and then they want to talk about it. Well, I need to have at least a working understanding of what these technologies in my area, which is data insights, are. And I think what, and not just for me, but for my group, I mean, we find ourselves experienced in a certain area, But then functionally, to be able to do projects for people, you know, we'll have to have a working knowledge. So what do we get? So three things were on that exam. I'm going to tell you what they are. One, batch. Two, streaming. Three, Azure Data Factory. So one, batch is what I learned when I was in school. You take a data set and then you analyze it. And Andy, to your point, a lot of people who go to school, it's already in that shape because they're trying to get them to learn the new thing, which is the modeling. But to learn how to get it into the batch is part of the work. Say channel two on the Lambda architecture is a streaming. And in our team, we're not focused on the serving part. You know, we'll partner with modern apps, or we might just do a simple Power BI on the other side. And then, but the third channel of Azure Data Factory is the third part of that particular exam. And, you know, we can see that those topics are, we had two choices between our exams, either the 70, 473 or the 475. And the other one is a lot more data engineering, a little bit off topic for me. But this second one, it does represent some of the projects that we're already talking about with some clients.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, Mark, what is your favorite part of your current gig?
I think my favorite part, you know, this has been, I feel it's been a good year. And I, you know, with any role, okay, our team formed during the course of the year. I was originally contacted by somebody who was going to be my manager, who left the role before I actually started. So then I was reported to a second manager, and then I was adopted by a third manager. It's just the way, you know, things change. And we're in a changing area. And I actually am the type of person, I actually like change. I like large unstructured problems, and I actually like some amount of change and bringing order to chaos, frameworks to, you know, uncertainty. So I have had the chance to do that. Now, sometimes it's been a little bit stressful because it seems like there's so much to do. But at the same time, you know, I am working. I really like my team of lead data scientists. We got six of us that are working worldwide. And then we have people who are very curious and interested about data. And that's one thing I did want to say on this podcast. You know, my manager, he's trained as a marine biologist. However, he's totally into this topic. You know, he goes to the same meetings. He is planning for our group strategically. And even my skip level, so that's his manager, he himself went through the professional data science degree and he finished it. Even his background is SharePoint, as I understand. So I think the people in my area, you know, there's a desire for people to learn analytics. And, of course, in my particular area, of course, that would be true because now they find themselves in data insights. But, you know, one thing that's great, too, is just the conferences. I have a chance to go to a lot of conferences now. And back when I was a consultant and I was, you know, running my own solo practice, I go to a conference. I'm not billing. If I'm billing, it's only a couple of hours at night or whatever it is. And then I have to pay for my own travel. Okay, now if I get approved travel, Microsoft pays for it. I go as an employee. And, you know, I can go to enjoy the conference. And, and I'm going to be speaking at an internal conference pretty soon about the team data science process, which is it's a project on GitHub, but it describes how to work together with a team on data science. And it's at the beginning of its discussion. There are ambitions to do more with it and maybe even turn it into some sort of framework that could be deployed on Azure. You know, I would love to see that happen.
Interesting. Because my experience internally at Microsoft, and granted, you know, I left almost 6 months ago, was there was a lot of activity in the product groups, and clearly a lot of activity that's been going on for years within MSR, which Microsoft Research. So it's very exciting, I bet, to be kind of on that cutting edge of, you know, you're bringing an MCS, you're bringing that solution to the customers.
Right. And there's several aspects. I mean, one is just hiring. You know, we're trying to hire into our area, finding people that have not only the training, but also have some client-facing experience, being able to deal with escalations or, you know, things that go wrong. You know, I have a lot of ability to solve issues on my own, and my manager wants me to do that, really only escalate if it's absolutely necessary, because he's got a lot of people reporting to him, and we're all really expected to have a lot more experience in my particular group, as I think a lot of consultants are. So right. It's similar to work I've done in the past. You know, I think work I did with Microsoft partners in the past was a good thing, because I could understand how they approach consulting. And then, you know, also I work myself with SaaS consulting, and then with so many other organizations prior to coming to Microsoft. So I've seen a number of different ways that people approach technical projects.
So would you say, did you find data, or did data find you?
Did I find data, or did data?
Yeah. Did you pick the data science life, or did the data science life find you?
I think I selected it. So, I think what interested me about, first of all, when I was going to school, there were early on, if you're going to go down the path I had early on when I was in my undergraduate degree, I was taking all the math classes and all the physics classes at UCLA that were for engineers and scientists. And the rough understanding there is that a scientist really works on theoretical problems, and an engineer works on practical problems. That's the old way of thinking about the question. Now, the word scientist has been through the washing machine in the last 20 years, so I don't know exactly where people fit when they think of the word scientist. But I do feel, and I've challenged some people with this too, how many people have the word science on their college degree, like computer science? You know, why can't I call them a scientist? I mean, you don't have to be Einstein to be a scientist. I mean, people do science in very practical ways. What? Is Einstein the only scientist? And he wasn't even a scientist. He was a physicist. I mean, he was. So, I don't want to put too much magic on that word. I think it's a very applied word. It goes to the scientific method. It is tied to what I mentioned earlier, the team data science process. And so when you talk about data, so I made a choice. And the choice was, am I going to become a theoretical person, or am I going to become an applied person? And I think that was clear in my choices of later on graduate programs, in my case. And even when I was at Georgia Tech, I spent an extra year taking extra math courses because that's the type of geek I am, which I did not need to take, extending my degree for another year. But in retrospect, not a bad choice, because it gave me a little bit more exposure to a lot more mathematical methods. And I don't know. I mean, we're getting a lot of my career's gone. And I'm not saying I'm ready to retire tomorrow, but I'm just saying I'm beginning to be skeptical of some of the things I learned in school will ever come up in a conversation. Never in before retirement. But nevertheless, I still feel, you know, people need to do what they enjoy. And I feel fortunate in this sense. I had the opportunity to make choices. And I know that's not true for everybody, but I made some choices early on, and that, you know, they were a long time ago. And we happen to be now in a world that, or a situation, or at least I find myself in a career where people are finding that type of skill set valuable. So now I have to do what I can to learn technology. That's not something that existed, you know, when I was in college. So I have to do my work, just like we all do. If we want to be in this field, you got to keep up with the technology. But as far as the math side, that side, you know, has been something was a good investment.
Right. It's hard to go wrong with studying math in a very deep way. It's hard to It's hard to have less options for knowing more math.
Yeah. So.
And that's coming from someone who despised math until about junior year of high school. So.
Oh, you hated it, huh?
Oh, I despised it. Despised it. Many, many stories I could tell about that, but I just think the way it's presented is once I learned kind of trigonometry and the practical application of algebra, something inside my mind just lit on fire. Like I was sitting all those years on a whole bunch of gasoline and nothing took. And then one day I realized, oh, this is why you do it. This is why it was invented. And then kaboom, like you couldn't stop me.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Well, you know, we could take a little diversion down this path. I was very fortunate. I went to a community college for my associate's degree, and I was very fortunate in that the physics teacher and the calculus teacher were friends, and they had decided to teach the both curricula so that they aligned. And it was very practical, very much get your hands in it, and you would learn the theory maybe in calculus first, but then you would go right into physics class a day later and put it into practice. And I don't see how you learn it any other way unless you just have a memory and a desire to memorize a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, I know you've done some teaching yourself.
I have done teaching, and my first teaching experience was in graduate school. I was a doctoral student, and a number of us got to teach while we were in school. At first, I was just like the aide, you know, maybe for the undergraduate or the graduate classes. And then I got my first teaching assignment in graduate school. I was teaching a group of undergraduate statistics and 40 people in the class. And I will say back then, I didn't get any training. They just gave me a book and a class role. They said, go, you know, whatever. Like not even a kind of an outline of how to approach it. So I just did it my way.
Yeah.
I got to teach that in a number of other classes there. I was interested in total quality management, so I got to teach that class while I was a graduate student. I put teaching away for a number of years, but then I came back by accident. I was trying to help somebody find a job, and it was like 2005, and I said, all right, I'm going to help you find a job, but I wasn't looking for a job. And I went on monster.com, and I was helping him. And while I was helping him, there was literally a banner ad for University of Phoenix, which I clicked and led to me teaching at University of Phoenix. And since then, have supervised, you know, 7 doctor management dissertations and taught some classes there, including graduate statistics.
Wow.
And since then, now that phase is coming to an end, and I'm not going to go into the full reasons of why I'm stopping, but I decided that I'm going to be stopping that activity. Meanwhile, I just finished, and then this is again another of my busy last week. I had to finish my writing a course for a local college, which is Brunel University. I came to know them through our Microsoft DX team, and we went to visit about 2 years ago, and while we were talking about Azure ML and their curriculum, they mentioned they were developing this class. And so we continued conversation. Well, now I've written that class, and that class is going to start online for their small program this month. So it's a 7-week class. And I'll tell you what the book is in case people want to get it. It's called Data Science for Business. Business. And I'm going to do a shout out for another class I wrote because I'm going to recommend another book. Let me make sure I get the name right. This one was for University of Phoenix. This was a undergraduate class, and it was about visualization and data. And so let me see if I can find the name of that book. Cole Nussbaumer Nafik, Storytelling with Data. That is a Wiley book, bestseller. And I think Jen Underwood said she knows the author. I don't know if it was Jen Underwood, but that book is what the value of that book is. A lot of us know how to tell stories. So the question is, where do we learn how to tell stories with data? And does it make a difference? How does it make a difference? And so that book is one of the best books I found. In fact, so good enough that they felt that was good enough for a college course. So that one is running at University of Phoenix on that topic, and that's good for that visualization layer. Pretty much that course just follows that book. Yeah.
Very cool. Since her name's been brought up twice already in this podcast, she's actually been a guest on a previous show, Jen Underwood.
Oh, Jen Underwood. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Self-promotion.
I think she actually told us to talk to you, Mark, and I smacked my head right after she suggested that and went, oh, yeah, duh. Of course. Let's talk to Mark. I bet you were going to talk about Jen. What were you going to say?
I was going to talk about Jen. So I met Jen Underwood in Atlanta, and I think at the time she was a consultant. This was her pre-Microsoft phase, and she's, of course, had several voyages into the Microsoft world and then into Tableau, and I've just known her for a while. And, of course, I recommend her blog and her Twitter feed. You know, you all need to go find it if you don't know where it is. I mean, her blog is outstanding. In fact, when I saw her blog, I go, I only aspire to have a blog that looks that good, just in the artwork. And when she told me how she produced,
the animation too. Open. The amount of animation on her website is just so well done. It's just, it's just, I look at that website and I aspire to attain that level of like artistry and animation. It's just incredible.
But it does support what she is. I mean, that's her business, and it's not only what she talks about, content, it's also the construct.
Right. Well, I'd like to ask you, take a little bit of a pivot here and ask you this question. Complete this sentence. When I'm not working, I enjoy.
Right. And what I want to call out for here is one thing I've done for a while is partner dancing. And it's just been a kind of a passion of mine to social dance. It's been mostly swing, sometimes salsa. But I also got involved in organizing an event. And, of course, I'm part of a team, so it's not a whole lot of work. But it is work, and it's volunteer. But we have an event coming up in June called Atlanta Lindy Exchange. And it's going to be over a weekend in June, and we're hoping to get at least 100 people. I don't know what the projection is, but it's just a weekend of dancing and venues and live music and good times. And I've helped with a number of events similar to that in the past. But it's a wide variety. You know, what it does, and I find a lot of people in the dancing community are also in IT somehow. I don't know why that's true. It just seems like it's a common theme. But independent of that, a lot of these people are very artistic, generally. Mm-hmm. So I got a lot of artistic-type friends that have other artistic interests. Perhaps they're musicians, or they are painters, or they are something else. So I value it not just for the dancing itself, but also it broadens my range of people that I know. And certainly, you know, just different people that I probably would not encounter in my professional world.
Well, we do see a lot of that. A lot of people of artistic talent in the technical communities, and I'm not sure why. I suspect it has something to do with being creative. Both are very creative activities, but I hear you. That's an interesting thing to be engaged with. We have another complete this sentence. I think the coolest thing in technology today is.
To me, the coolest thing when I was thinking about this fill-in is social connections. Now, it's kind of a double-edged sword because it could be the plus and it could be the minus. But I think for me, it is definitely a plus. When I think about, for example, my family, and we're about to have a family reunion coming up at the end of this month, you know, around Memorial Day. So it's a lot easier now for us to keep up with family and family events,
right?
I think using social technology. And I know some of my family members who are older, maybe my mom's generation, you know, they didn't grow up with digital. They are digital immigrants. I am a digital immigrant because when I was born, we were not in a digital world. But we got a lot of digital natives now, I mean, people who are born, and that's the only world they know. So, and that's the way they communicate. So that's where the focus is. And I think for, you know, for families to stay together, to figure out a way to do that digitally is a worthwhile journey. It doesn't have to be Facebook. It doesn't have to be traditional social media. But I think people are finding ways to connect. And, you know, I find ways to have meaningful conversations with people.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's an interesting distinction, digital natives versus, what was the term?
Digital immigrants.
Digital immigrants. That is an interesting distinction.
I am totally an immigrant. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and that I think that's going to have some very interesting side effects and unintended consequences, good and bad, for, you know, as I see my kids who are digital natives, and I'm of the age where I can remember a life before the internet. And it's just interesting to see how their look at the world is different because of that. Mm-hmm. A good example would be, you know, my kids expect to watch whatever they want at any time, almost anywhere, on any device.
Mm-hmm.
Where I remember when a Christmas special came on, like, you know, Rudolph or Frosty, it was on once for the entire mm-hmm. year. And if you missed it, that was it.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting, yeah.
And then what's funny is my mom one year texted me, you know, feverishly, called me feverishly to the point where I thought something was wrong. And she said, no, you know, Frankie, she calls me Frankie. Hey, Frankie, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer's on tonight. You got to watch it with the boys. Like, you got to watch it tonight. And I didn't have the heart to tell her that, you know, they had seen it like three times in the car's DVD player that week.
Oh, wow.
You know, I was actually kind of sick of hearing it. But I mean, it just speaks to kind of just the different expectations that a digital native would have versus a digital immigrant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is definitely an interesting perspective, Mark, because it is truly a cultural difference between those two groups.
It is.
Yeah. Well, cool. Okay, another complete this sentence. I look forward to the day when I can use technology to.
Okay, so here's what I want. I saw an article yesterday that Japan is needing so many people to work in small to medium-sized manufacturing. They can't find people. And this has led, therefore, to enough money to develop these robots to work alongside human workers.
Oh, wow.
All right, so here's what I want. I want, you know what I want as a lead data scientist? I want a data science army. I want an army of data science bots. And I don't know how far we're away from that. I mean, I think that's going to happen before I retire.
All right, Mark, wait a minute. This is freaking me out a little bit. I mean, we're not going Skynet Terminator here, are we?
No, I mean, we're giving a bot an outline of what you want to accomplish, which is okay. What you do in a functional language. Okay, okay. So now we got these functional languages. You tell it what you want to accomplish, and then the bot will figure out how, and it has a range. So, and I'll give you an example. Today I'm having to do some regressions, so I'm having to test them one at a time. And, you know, this is where something like BIML is steering ourselves in that direction.
Sure.
So we have to have a world where we're going to be able to launch a number of parallel investigations at the same time without me having to manually do that. Now, yes, could I write it now in PowerShell? I probably could, but by the time I find what I'm looking for, it's not worth it for me necessarily to build a bot, if you see what I'm saying. Bots are buildable. Bots are buildable. We are building them now. If anyone has not seen that Q&A maker demonstration from Microsoft, it's very impressive. It takes an FAQ on a website and it turns it into a bot. Okay, questions and answers. You just have the questions and answers. So if you have something that's like the question, then it will come up with the answer. That's how the bot works. It's initially programmed right off of an FAQ.
I can't wait for that technology to be integrated with MSDN documentation.
Yeah.
And what I was going to say is I think we're pivoting into a different movie now, where the movie iRobot, where we have the hologram of the scientist, and the scientist keeps saying, you know, that's not a question. I can answer, or that's not the right question.
Right.
So I absolutely love that idea. And one more movie reference, and then I'll shut up. From Passengers, where there's this conversation going on between the bartender and the gentleman who's been awakened early, and he's lamenting all these emotions. And the bartender says, these are not robot questions. I love that line. I think that's hilarious.
Yes.
So, it reminds me of my Alexa when she says, I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
That's right. That's funny. So I see what you're saying, Mark, and I kind of get the automation aspect of it as well. Like, you know, and I understand how Bimmel could maybe, you know, present the data or different facets of the data. You could automate small chunks, and then, you know, Bimmel certainly can't go into the engines yet and do things with, like, you know, have machine learning perform regressions for you, or even R perform the regressions for you. But that kind of automation is coming. It's clearly coming, and it has to. And someone made a statement that that they think the potential is there for data science to be automated prior to maybe many of the other jobs out there, because data scientists are doing so much automation. They already know how to do data science. So they're teaching these machines to do the things that they know how to do. What do you think about that?
I do. I you know, there's this area of philosophy which I'm interested in because of my interest in Christianity, but the topic is anthropology, and the question is, what makes a person? This is a classic question in philosophy.
Yeah.
What is a person is a deep philosophical question, but I think practically it's going to be important as people map their careers, because it used to be we needed to talk people into their need to use automation.
Right.
Now the question is, what is automation going to take over in terms of work? And therefore,
right,
where should I personally spend my professional development time? Because this task, whatever it is I'm doing, is something only a person could do.
Yeah, and that's that. Actually, that pool is shrinking, right? The things that only a person can do.
Right. Some of them, and I'll give the short list. Anything requiring judgment is going to be a person, or weighing,
sure,
what we call values against application, that's still going to be a person. And there is some amount of that that still does happen in data science. Some of it happens in the area of ethics, for example. And so some scientific investigations are not the right thing to do because they're unethical.
Right.
Well, a person would know that. A machine let out in the wild might not know that. Now, I don't know, probably somebody's already written a science fiction story about that. But I'm just saying that people tend to have cultural sensitivities and values.
Right.
And that's one area of, and sometimes the cultural sensitivities may have nothing to do with what we think of as culture. Sometimes there may be a corporate culture, or it
right,
might be a culture for that industry, the way the industry looks at something. So there's different ways to look at culture. And so I think even for the client facing work that I do, there will still always be a need for somebody to discuss what a business problem is, take those values, translate them into a work plan and into a solution. That task right there, I think a lot of it could be automated along the way in terms of having, you know, like fill in the blanks, but
right,
still has to be a guided conversation to negotiate viewpoints of different people and come to a consensus is still something that people will largely have to do.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have the one last question here.
Sure.
Share something different about yourself.
Share something different. Maybe I can tell a story.
Sure.
That sounds different.
5 years ago, I had really long hair, and I decided I was going to take a passport photo. And that choice got me detained last year in Toronto, and by Canadian, immigration. They commented I did not look like my photo, and they wondered why I was there for a business trip. It was a Microsoft trip. Well, just last week, I probably had my worst experience being detained in Ottawa. I was there for 5 hours, and now what happened? I have since gotten a different passport photo, so that was not the issue this time. But the issue was, you know, we've seen you before, and even the officer said, you know, we've seen you like four times in Canada in the last year, which was Toronto, Montreal, Edmonton, and then now Ottawa. And it's like, okay, they keep seeing me show up on their radar for work purposes, and they're wondering, you know, why am I here, and they're wanting a work permit, which is really a tax. That's what they really want. So we did get it sorted out. On the backside of that, I'm going to be a bit preemptive on travel to Canada, make sure I only travel during the week. I traveled on a Sunday, which is not a good day to travel if you need to call someone.
Gotcha. Well, this has been a really great interview and a great podcast. Mark, I appreciate you coming on. Frank, I know you've enjoyed it. I've done most of the talking, I think, on this interview. And I don't know whether to apologize for that or not, but I've really enjoyed it, Mark, the give and take. Anytime I have an opportunity to have a conversation with you, I learn things. And I just, it's a great joy to have a chat with you about any subject, especially what your, you know, what your passion is. And you're clearly passionate about data science, and I'm just glad to see it.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for coming, and really enjoyed our conversation. Where can folks find out more about what you're up to?
I'd love to connect people on LinkedIn, and they can find me on there. And then also on Twitter at MarkTabNet. Mark Tab, T-A-B. N-E-T.
Thanks for listening to Data Driven. Don't just listen. Become a data driver by going to datadriven.tv to sign up to join the community, access to special events, tips and tricks, and more. Sign up today at datadriven.tv.